WVW Broadcast Network and The New American are pleased to present The New American TV. This broadcast is committed to helping you understand the truth behind the news. Now, here's your host, Paul Dragoo.
Welcome to The New American TV, where we bring you the truth behind the news. It's Monday, April 10th, and I'm your host, Paul Dragoo. So later in the show, we're going to play an interview Alex Newman conducted with someone who incurred the wrath of the J6 Kangaroo Court. We'll also show an interview with National Home Education Research Institute founder and president Dr. Brian Ray, who makes the case that homeschool children perform far better than government-schooled ones in every metric. And we'll wrap it up with the latest on the legislative front from the John Birch Society's legislative and research team. But first, let's look at the news we're following today. In Austin, Texas, a jury found former Sergeant Daniel Perry guilty of murder for shooting a BLM protester during a riot in Austin in 2020.
A Travis County jury yesterday convicted Daniel Perry of murder. He shot Air Force veteran Garrett Foster, who is white, five times during a protest in 2020. Perry was driving for Uber when he encountered Foster and other protests in downtown Austin. Perry claims he opened fire in self-defense because Foster was carrying an AK-47 rifle. But prosecutors contend Perry had other options for dealing with the situation, including driving away.
Like the newscast said, Perry was driving for Uber and his car was blocked and surrounded by protesters who began beating on the vehicle. When one of them, Garrett Foster, pointed an AK-47 at him through his window, Perry shot and killed the man. Unfortunately, what was a clear-cut case of self-defense was distorted by Austin's radical George Soros-backed DA, Jose Garza. Garza has a long track record of going after policemen who shoot violent offenders while simply ignoring violent felons. Garza's office has dropped dozens of felony cases while indicting more than 20 police officers who responded forcefully during the 2020 riots. Fortunately for Perry, Texas Governor Greg Abbott has already announced that he will be working to pardon the former sergeant. Texas law does not permit governors to pardon at will, but instead requires them to request a pardon from the Board of Pardons and Paroles. The Texas Attorney General has lashed out at Garza, saying that he has weaponized the judicial system and given in to the racial agenda of the woke mob. And here's some news on the other side of the life and death spectrum. On Friday, a federal judge in Texas concluded that the FDA violated its statutory duty when it approved the abortion pill mifepristone more than 20 years ago. U.S. District Judge Matthew Kaczmarek ordered a hold on the abortion pill and allowed 1 week for the government to appeal his ruling before it goes into effect. If the decision does go into effect, it would prohibit pharmacies from selling mifepristone, a ban that would apply nationwide. This would greatly reduce the number of abortions in America. More than half of all abortions in the U.S. are medication-induced, according to the pro-abortion Guttmacher Institute. Pushback against this ruling began even before it was issued. Last Tuesday, Washington State Governor Jay Inslee warned that a judge in Texas could take action jeopardizing the availability of mifepristone. And he said Washington has already stocked up on the abortion pill to make sure there's enough available in his state.
So in order to address this emergent attack and access to effective health care, I have directed our State Department of Corrections to purchase a 3-year supply of mifepristone. It's about 30,000 doses. The department is able to make this purchase using existing statutory authority. The purchase has been made. The shipment has arrived. It is in our possession.
After this ruling, U.S. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez urged the Biden administration to simply ignore the decision.
Is that I believe that the Biden administration should ignore this ruling. I think that we, the courts have the legitimacy and they rely on the legitimacy of their rulings. And what they are currently doing is engaged in an unprecedented and dramatic erosion of the legitimacy of the courts.
Does the Biden administration agree with AOC? Asked about this, Health and Human Services Secretary Xavier Becerra said everything is on the table. And here's more good pro-life news. Idaho has just become the first state to restrict out-of-state travel for minors seeking an abortion without parental consent. Last Wednesday, Republican Governor Brad Little signed House Bill 242, making abortion trafficking a felony offense. Idaho is one of the most pro-life states in the union, and this new law not only prohibits traveling with a minor to another state for an abortion, it also makes it illegal to help a minor get abortion-inducing drugs. Violators will face up to 5 years in prison. The law goes into effect in May, but Planned Parenthood has already vowed legal action against it. Misty Delicarpini-Tolman is Idaho State Director with Planned Parenthood in Meridian. She ignored the fact that the law protects minors when she described the legislation to King 5 News in Seattle.
I think this should be a giant red flag for everyone. We have a state that's not only telling its residents what health care they can access within its own borders, but they're also now trying to tell its residents what health care they can access outside of its borders, basically amounting to medical surveillance.
Stanton Healthcare, a pregnancy help center in Boise, helped craft the bill and promoted its passage.
We coined the phrase abortion trafficking. It was actually Stanton working with Right to Life of Idaho that came up with that phrase because of the way that the abortions have been pushed on our young women. So when we found out that they were coming up with this bill, we really wanted to be involved. We just believe that young women facing unexpected pregnancies deserve better than abortion.
They expect better than abortion. Well said. So joining me to discuss today's stories is the New American's editor-in-chief, Gary Benoit. Gary, welcome.
Thank you. Hi, Paul.
So we have three stories, all of life and death. And one I think is pretty sad, you know, that we live in an America now where you will have to second guess before you defend yourself. But then again, of course, on the pro-life front, we keep getting good news. What do you have to say about?
Well, first of all, I think there's quite a contrast between Washington State in Idaho is to the political leadership.
Yeah, and they're neighbors too.
I know. what a difference.
Right.
But I imagine Washington State is heavily swayed by the West Coast. There's quite a difference in Washington between the east and west western parts of the state.
Oh, there absolutely is. I've been to those states numerous times, and I think there's even a campaign. I'm not sure if it includes Eastern Washington, but it may to break that part off. And you know, the Eastern right. Washingtonians, they want to join a sane state. But isn't it telling the length that these people will go to? I mean, they stocked up on baby killing pills is
right.
what it is.
And that's exactly what they are, because what you're talking about is killing innocent human life. And how can any civilized society do that? And I think this story really illustrates the fact that ultimately the solution is morality. Freedom cannot be enjoyed by an immoral people. And, you know, thankfully there are still many people who are moral, many people who are God-fearing, who worship God, who support their families, and, work hard for a living and who love their country. But obviously there are others where their morality has gone down the tubes. And it shows the importance that while we fight the battle politically, we also fight the battle to change the hearts and minds of the people.
You know, my understanding, when Roe v. Wade was passed, it was a different time, even for pro-abortionists. My understanding was that abortion was looked at as something, first of all, not to be celebrated, but some sort of, you know, necessary, mm-hmm. but it still had some shame into it. Is that correct? Because you were kind
yes,
of around
that. That is absolutely correct. Yes, I was born in 1953.
You didn't, yeah.
but of course, the decision that Roe v. Wade was early in the year. It was in January, and I was 19 years old at the time. But it was scandalous at the time to get abortion. Mm-hmm. In almost every state, abortion was outlawed. Those laws were overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court by Roe versus Wade. And I believe at the time there were many people who may have seen that as a good thing. People who were pro-life may have seen that as a good thing to have this visited by the by the national government, because they probably imagined that the decision would have gone the opposite way that it did. And it does show the dangers of how the liberty of an entire nation can be endangered by getting rid of the concept of federalism and to have the national government stick its nose into a place where the national government does not belong. But obviously, over the years, in the Roe versus Wade era, many people did get abortions, and the number of increased over time, and people acquiesced to it, and they got more used to it. And you might have had a daughter getting an abortion, or you might have had a grandchild getting an abortion, or somebody close to you getting an abortion. And step by step, I think the opposition that people had to abortion back in 1973 got eroded.
Yeah.
But, thank God, too, that there were pro-lifers who were not about to fold, who drew a line in the sand, and they said enough is enough, that human life is sacrosanct, and even the Supreme Court does not have high enough a pay grade to take away innocent human life, and who have fought the fight against abortion over all these many decades. And, of course, their efforts have had a lot to do with causing many people today to counteract the propaganda for abortion, and obviously had everything to do with ultimately what happened with the Supreme Court when the Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade. But, of course, the fight continues on the state level.
Yeah, the pro-life movement is very inspirational, because sometimes we hear, for instance, at the John Birch Society, we hear quite often, like, why are you guys still pushing that campaign? Because it looks hopeless. And lately, the answer that I've been giving them is, look at what the pro-life movement achieved.
I know.
They fought for decades. Ever since Roe v. Wade, they fought and they fought and they fought. And there was a lot of behind-the-scenes finagling and lobbying and persuading with Donald Trump. I've read numerous articles on that, and they said, look, you know, for instance, very influential people said, I got a big segment, I got a big demographic of people who follow me. I need you to make sure that if you get in office, you're going to put a pro-life judge in there. And he did it. And that was part of the pressure. And so kudos to it may be the most important movement that we have in America. So go back to the first story in Texas there. Man, that is just so sad. And to think it could happen in Texas, of course, some will point out, well, it happened in Austin.
Yep. I'm sure many people in Texas would argue that Austin is not really part of Texas.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's unfortunately, that's the way it is with a lot of these big these red states. I lived in a red state with a purple cap, with a very blue capital and whatnot. So unfortunately, we know. But it's like, what are you to do when you get to a point, and this is happening regularly, it seems now, where you can't necessarily defend yourself anymore. The man pointed an AK-47 at him, and he shot him. Obviously, his training kicked in. But apparently, he should have just not driven. It's his fault for driving in an area of the city where he's allowed, where it's public, because he should have not driven there. He should have known better. What kind of defense is that?
Well, it's ludicrous, of course. You know, the argument being he could simply drive away, but I don't think you have to be in the middle of a riot. And thankfully, I never have been in the middle of a riot.
Yeah.
But I don't think you have to be there to know what it might be like in terms of one's ability to retreat, because we certainly have seen footage, Paul, where you're literally surrounded, and you try to get out, you try to drive out, and then you can be accused of running over somebody or hurting somebody, and convicted for that.
Right.
So I don't believe he had a choice. He did not have the option of retreating.
And he was working, right?
Yes, he was Uber driving.
Right.
I don't know if he had a passenger at the time.
Right. I mean, it's just, and again, that should never be a logical offense. Well, you know, he shouldn't have driven in an area of the city where people can drive, you know, because there was a riot there. And it's like, well, the guy was working. But secondly, that's still not, what's the guy doing pointing a gun at? Everyone knows you don't point guns at people unless you intend to shoot them or get shot back. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, he probably wasn't intending to say to the guy in the car, gee, look at this nice gun I have.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Good guy. And, and it's not a given that Abbott will be able to pardon him. Obviously, there's there's a little more of a procedure, and hopefully this goes through. And obviously, Abbott has heard quite a bit.
Right.
So we'll see what follows in this.
Yeah, we will. But I do want to interject, though, that just like the abortion issue, it really comes down to understanding, comes down to moral understanding, as well as understanding in terms of, you know, the sum of good government, understanding in terms of being a good citizen, and understanding one's responsibility on a jury.
Yeah.
And, you know, juries are being dumbed down just like the population as a whole is being dumbed down. But rather than lamenting that, we can should consider, number one, that Austin is not the USA. Not every jurisdiction is that way. Look at what happened in Milwaukee, for instance, with the young man who defended himself. And he was fully acquitted, and a lot of people were surprised by that.
Yeah.
But the jury, despite intimidation, made the proper decision.
Who would have thought, Milwaukee?
But ultimately, Paul, to save our freedoms, we got to wake the town. We got to tell the people. We got to get them involved. And that's what the John Birch Society, the parent organization of this magazine, is all about. And I would argue, without the John Birch Society, without everything that has been done for over 60 years, there would not have been MAGA. And as a matter of fact, I don't believe we'd be living in a free country today. I think we still have the means to save our freedoms because of everything that wonderful people in the John Birch Societies and their allies have done over so many years.
I agree with you. And a lot of what we're seeing, I believe, are growing pains. Are pains of pushing back against what, unfortunately, the tyranny and the infection that has taken over our society. Let's look at our last two stories here. So two Tennessee State Democratic representatives were expelled Thursday from the state's General Assembly after disrupting a floor session with the use of a bullhorn. Justin Jones of Nashville and Justin Pearson of Memphis broke house rules when they led an anti-gun protest in the middle of proceedings. A third member, Democrat Gloria Johnson from Knoxville, was also involved in the disruption. She barely survived being ousted. Since Jones and Pearson are black and Johnson is white, charges of racism were inevitable. However, House Speaker Cameron Sexton told Fox News the reason she narrowly escaped was because she didn't scream and yell and she didn't grab the bullhorn like the other two. Sexton compared the disturbance to an insurrection. Fellow Republican Gino Bulso, who sponsored the resolution to expel Johnson, said the three Democratic representatives effectively conducted a mutiny and that Jones showed no remorse or recognized that he was doing anything wrong. Their party's supermajority needed a two-thirds vote to expel. It's the first time the Tennessee House has overridden a member's election for violating House rules. Commentators say this could set a dangerous precedent. Other legislators have been expelled in bipartisan votes, but only after having criminal charges or sexual misconduct allegations filed against them. Jones told reporters that Republicans are trying to make an example of the Tennessee Three, as they're already known. This is a political lynching, he said, but we will not back down. Here's how he defended himself ahead of the expulsion vote.
We called for you all to ban assault weapons, and you respond with an assault on democracy. That is why the nation is watching you today. And I say to my colleagues on the other side of the aisle that no matter what you vote, you have the votes, but you will not be victorious because there are generations of young people who see what is going on.
Critics say the expulsion is extreme and that there are more practical and proportionate measures for disciplining House rule violations. They routinely fail to mention that the demonstrators stormed the Capitol chamber, egged on by the three lawmakers who led them in disrupting the House for the better part of an hour.
Can't have people getting too close to the truth, can you? Of course, that demonstration was in the wake of a terrible crime committed in Nashville, Tennessee this week.
The Tennessee Democratic Party is already fundraising to back all three of them in special elections, and the ousted two already say they want to get reelected. Tennessee's constitution does not allow legislators to expel them twice for the same offense. And for our last story, here's one with a twist of irony. The journalist who broke the Twitter file story, articles that documented overt censorship at Twitter, said that he's leaving the bird over claims of censorship. Matt Taibbi said in an email to his subscribers on Friday that Twitter was blocking links to his Substack stories over concerns about the new Substack Notes feature, which he said they see as a hostile rival. When he asked about how he was supposed to market his work, he said he was given the option of posting his articles on Twitter instead of Substack. The decision was a no-brainer, and he chose the latter. Alex Berenson, another ideologically left journalist who once worked for corporate media but bucked the regime's COVID narrative, chimed in on the duel, taking a shot at owner Elon Musk. Berenson said, in 48 hours, Musk has burned up what's left of his credibility as a free speech champion. Musk, however, contradicted Taibbi's version of what happened. Substack links were never blocked. Matt's statement is false, Musk tweeted. As of Monday morning, Matt Taibbi is still on Twitter. On Wednesday, Substack's owners, who also accused Twitter of blocking links to their platform, announced they were launching the social media-like platform Substack Notes this week. The point of Notes will be for writers to be able to post short-form content and share ideas with each other and their readers. Substack's owners said that since launching in 2017, it has accrued more than 35 million active subscriptions, 2 million of which are paid subscriptions. Readers have paid hundreds of millions of dollars to writers on the platform, the owners have said. Well, that's all for our news segment today. For more Truth Behind the News, make sure to get a subscription to The New American Magazine. You can do so online at thenewamerican.com or by calling our office at 800-727-8783, Monday through Friday from 8 to 5 Central Time. That's 800-727-8783. We'll see you after the break.
I certainly would not want a constitutional convention. I mean, whoa. Who knows what would come out of that?
Just imagine if we have a constitutional convention, the number of people who will be unhappy and the number of people who say the results are not valid, and then they'll just ignore the entire Constitution.
What we need are just more people that would read the one we have.
It isn't the Constitution that's the problem. It is the people who ignore the Constitution that usurp power and abuse the constitutional power that they ostensibly have.
If you can't enforce an existing piece of paper, how are you going to enforce a piece of paper that has a little more writing to it? In other words, it's been amended.
It's up to us to hold our elected officials accountable.
What can you do to elect good representatives and senators in your state legislature who understand the Constitution and are willing to take a stand?
Kirsten Niemela was at the Capitol on January 6th in a Conversations That Matter interview with The New American's Alex Newman. Kirsten describes the scene that day and shares how she was arrested, tried in a kangaroo court, and convicted. The travesty of justice she has endured and continues to experience is incredible. Let's watch.
Welcome, everybody, to Conversations That Matter. I'm your host, Alex Newman, senior editor at The New American Magazine. Thank you for joining us. We have a very special guest today. An individual who was involved in the January 6th, mostly peaceful protest. Of course, there was the federal provocateurs, the Pantifa clowns, etc. This individual was caught up in that and has now been prosecuted and convicted. Her name is Kirsten Niemela. Kirsten, welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us. Give us a story. How did you end up getting involved in the January 6th protest and what happened next?
So it started, I went to the Stop the Steal rally in December. And then when Trump asked us to go, I felt the need that every American should be there. And, I took the drive down about 7 hours, got there the night before, met amazing patriots that night, went to the speech. I got there around, 5:30, the latest in the morning. And we stood in place, shoulder to shoulder with what I think to be like over a million people. It was the most peaceful thing I've ever attended. There was no fights. There was no cops. We sang the national anthem, Pledge of Allegiance, and then we peacefully walked down to the Capitol. And I did get caught up in the movement of going in. through an open door, mind you. I was peaceful. I didn't break anything. I didn't even touch anything. I walked through the ropes. And now my entire life has been turned upside down.
So what did they charge you with? And I guess you were convicted. You're planning on appealing, I understand. But what did they charge you with in federal court that you just went through in D.C.?
4 misdemeanors. I'm one of the very few that didn't take a plea deal. And everyone was like, oh, my God, you're really going to trial for misdemeanor charges? Yeah, because I'm not going to bow and break. And I know what comes after, you know, not you take a plea deal. You have no rights to anything, essentially. Yep. And I wasn't for that.
So what did they charge you with, Kirsten?
2 counts of disorderly and trespassing and demonstrating, parading, and picketing.
Huh. And so what's the consequence? Are they giving you jail time, a fine, or?
So my sentencing is May 31st. I do not know the fate of my future. Most people are getting prison time. Along with once you get out of prison, they're giving some people 2 to 5 years probation. They're hitting us with fines. You know, and as far as I see it, I've already been punished. I mean, I've been on federal probation before ever walking into a courtroom. You know, like I'm drug tested, my travel's restricted, I'm red flagged at the airlines. It's just a disaster. My phone's definitely tapped. I mean, it beeps every time I'm on my phone. They took my phone for 2 weeks, downloaded everything on my phone, whether it's private, personal, it doesn't matter. They have invaded all privacy. They blasted me on the news. They got tips from people saying that I broke a window in the Capitol, which is headlines, national and local news. I never broke a window. I never touched anything. That's not what I'm charged with. So they've defamed my character. You know, I lost some friends. I lost my job when all this started. It's just been a disaster.
Tell us a little bit about the so-called trial, the so-called prosecution that you endured. I mean, did it seem legit? Was it above board? Were your rights respected?
No. So I actually had public defenders, and they did not do their job at all. They basically told me I was guilty and were just doing it essentially for a paycheck, I guess, because they had no belief in anything. They clearly do not support the Constitution or Trump. And that was very clear. So basically, right before trial, we had filed all these motions of things to suppress and whatnot. And the government had filed motions that I'm not allowed to say the police let me in. I'm not allowed to use entrapment.
Did the judge accept that you weren't allowed to say that the police let you in? Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. Oh, oh my goodness.
And
we all saw the video. I mean, we saw the video of the cops letting people in. Can't let the jury know that. Huh?
Yep. And I wasn't allowed to mention Ashley Babbitt. Those were the motions that were filed. So then, of course, they wanted to show private text messages. They wanted to paint me in whatever picture they could. So we had filed a bunch of motions to suppress a lot of that. And my attorneys decided on their own, without my permission, that when we got to court, they were actually going to not object to anything that they were submitting because they felt they would look better if I didn't hide anything. I said, that's not how trial works. But so then my jury selection, well, first I never got a pretrial. And then my jury selection did not go well. I mean, we were in court till 6 o'clock that night just doing jury selection. And the first, I don't know, 10, the judge is like, well, this isn't looking good. And I'm thinking to myself, well, if you would have given me my change of venue, we wouldn't have this problem. Every juror lived within 2 miles of the Capitol. They were personally affected. Their husband works at the Capitol. Their best friend's a Capitol police officer. They're a lawyer. They work for the DOJ. I mean, it was an absolute sham. And then on top of that, you know, these people expressed that it's too personal for them. And then it's like the prosecution and the judge rehabs them back. Well, if I give you strict instructions, you know, can you put aside your personal feelings? And the hesitation in these people was very obvious. They were never going to give me a fair trial. And then the best part was we were striking our jurors, and my attorneys striked the wrong jurors. So we addressed the judge, and he explained that he messed up, and the judge would not let us correct it.
Oh, my goodness.
So that's how my trial started.
This sounds like communist China, where, you know, the defendant's lawyers are also working for the prosecution. I mean, what a joke. What an absolute joke.
Every morning I went to court, my lawyers were best friends with the FBI, and they're all shoving it up. I'm like, seriously? Is this real life? And then the FBI agent on my case got to sit at the prosecution table and help pick my jury. And sit in the room the entire time for everybody's testimony. But yet no other witness could be in the room until they testified.
Oh, unbelievable. Unbelievable, Kirsten. So obviously Tucker Carlson got access to the footage. You know, I thought it was pretty underwhelming. I frankly didn't learn a single thing from the footage. Everybody's acting like, oh, huge revelation. We all knew that. We all knew that the cops were letting people in. We all knew that the cops were walking people around the Capitol. I mean, really, we didn't learn much. But I think a lot of Americans who still live under the delusions of the fake media might have learned something. What are your thoughts on the narrative? You know, where are they with this narrative? Are people still buying it? Why are they doing this? I mean, what's their objective? Why do they have to persecute you guys and make an example of you? What's going on here?
Well, I think, well, we all know they don't want Trump to run. That's a fact. But I think that they, to be honest, I really just think they hate Americans. I don't think that they are in it for us at all. It's not we the people. It's not the Constitution. They want to abolish everything. They want to be filthy rich, run their sex trafficking cults, and do whatever they want and have nobody above them. And, you know, they all preach no one's above the law, but every single one of them, Obama, Clinton, I mean, we could give a whole list of people who have been running the streets free. And, you know, and then I throw them for a loop because I go against their narrative because I'm a gay conservative. So I get 10 times more hell for that from that whole community. And, you know, I call it the alphabet community, you know, the alphabet mafia. It's just insanity, you know. I don't know. I think that they know they're in trouble, and they know that Trump is going to bring down the system and bring them all down. And that is their biggest fear. Like, you know, the arrest that's supposed to happen. I mean, it's just insanity.
It's going to be an interesting couple of years. Kirsten, before we let you go, you told me before we went on that you're thinking about appealing. You've found now some private attorneys who hopefully are not working for the system and would rather represent their clients. What's next for you? What's next for your case?
I did hire a private attorney. That's the reason for my give, send, go. Very expensive. But they are going through my transcripts right now and figuring out which motions we're filing, whether we're filing for a new trial based on inadequate defense, prosecutor misconduct, many things. And if not, then we'll be going for an appeal.
Excellent. Well, Kirsten, thank you very much for joining us. Thank you for the update on your case. Hopefully we'll get you back once more is known. And yeah, best of luck to you. Thanks again.
Thank you.
All right, parents, listen up. We've all seen the countless examples of how radical leftists have been destroying American schools. It's no longer just about the terrible math and reading levels. Now radical left teachers birthed from liberal universities are forcing gender indoctrination in kindergarten. They're teaching lessons on white guilt.
Freedom Project Academy has perfected live online learning over the course of a decade. I get a ton of great feedback about this program, a ton.
They're built on Judeo-Christian values, a classical curriculum. What does that mean? It means they're taught, your children are taught the way that the founding generations of the country. My own son, Noah, did Freedom Project Academy for several years when he was younger.
The more we tell our friends about these things, the more people will get on board. And I believe that we can be the catalyst to some real change.
We must save the West. Our way of life and our culture is under attack. And because of patriots like you and your project, I have optimism for the future.
How does homeschooling compare to government schooling? The studies, data, and research show that children educated at home, on average, perform far better than their public school counterparts on every metric, including socialization, explains National Home Education Research Institute founder and president, Dr. Brian Ray, in a recent Conversations That Matter interview. Let's watch.
Welcome, everybody, to Conversations That Matter for the New American Magazine. Thank you so much for joining us. I am your host, Alex Newman. Our guest today, he is, I think, the world leader when it comes to understanding the data, the research, what the studies show about homeschooling. And he approaches this as a scholar. You know, even though he's got his own opinions about things, he's got his own religious views, he approaches this issue of the research from an objective, scholarly, academic point of view. And, you know, that comes out very clearly in his research. He's the president of the National Home Education Research Institute. You can find him online at nheri.org. He's known around the world for his research on homeschooling. He's done numerous peer-reviewed studies, books, chapters in books over, you know, almost 40 years of this. He's testified as an expert witness in courts, in legislatures. He's served as a professor at the undergraduate and graduate levels. He's got a PhD in science education from Oregon State University. Dr. Brian Ray, welcome to the program. Thank you so much for joining us. So let's start with a really, I think, obvious question, the gorilla in the room. Does homeschooling work? Is it a good thing from the perspective of producing children who are well-educated, socialized in the sense that, you know, it's commonly understood, socialization? And do they do okay as adults? What does the research show?
Yeah, it's great. You know, people have been asking that now for the, you know, 40 years of the modern homeschool movement, Alex. And I like how you said I'm a researcher, but let's face it, everybody has something that drives what they do. I do try to be honest with numbers, okay? That's what we try to do. And so one time I thought, you know what? I'm just going to do a review of research on studies that made it into peer-reviewed journals just for fun. Let's just narrow it down because, you know, there's a lot of research now. But when I took just those studies and I updated that review just a couple months ago when I was headed down to Florida for a conference on school choice with a capital S and C that we might talk about later, I summarize these, and 63% of peer-reviewed studies that deal with academic achievement show that the home educated are doing statistically significantly better than those in conventional schools. So we don't even really have a level playing field anymore. We have a playing field where it says, hey, you know what? It's a little higher there for the home educated. And maybe we'll have time to get into why. So I'm just going to give you the stats for a minute. And maybe let's maybe go back about why. Then secondly, this is a question that homeschool families and anybody who thought maybe parent-directed home-based education was okay after it was okay for thousands of years before we had institutional schools take over by 1900. What about socialization? You know, and as I look at that question, Alex, I think, did anybody ask Abraham Lincoln's mom, what about socialization? We're worried about Abe, you know, or what about socialization for Thomas Edison's mom or, you know, for him or, you know, any of the other millions of people who were scientists, candlestick makers, blacksmiths, businessmen, businesswomen, moms, dads. Nobody worried about that, you know, up until 1900. But anyway, here we go. So 64% of peer-reviewed studies have found that the home educated do statistically significantly better than those in institutional schools in terms of social and emotional development measured in all kinds of ways. Okay, then the third thing that I looked at was, all right, so, hey, maybe they're doing okay or well academically, maybe they're doing okay or well socially and emotionally, but what about now that they're in adulthood? So I looked for all those studies, peer-reviewed studies, and 50% of those studies found that the home educated are doing statistically significantly better than those who went to institutional schools. Now, people might say, well, what about the other 50%? Well, it mostly is like mixed or no difference. That's on almost all of these. There's no trend the other way. The trend in these studies is that the home educated are doing at least as well and actually notably better than those who go to institutional public and private schools. That's just what we know. And by the way, some people say, I've had all kinds of scholars attack my work and criticize my work, and which is fun. That's what scholars do. We criticize each other and we look for the perfect study. But these studies are by many people. These are not just studies by Brian Ray. Just a little context there.
Yeah. And, you know, that's not surprising to me, somebody who's been in homeschool world for a while. You know, I homeschool my five children. Obviously, I am biased in favor of home education. I think it's phenomenal. It's amazing. But when you interact with homeschool families, you realize their children are, on average, super well educated. They're very social. They can deal with people of all ages. And as you just confirmed, the scientific, the peer-reviewed literature shows overwhelmingly that homeschoolers do better across the spectrum on all these different areas. And yet, Brian, we have growing hostility in certain quarters to homeschooling. We've got people like Harvard's Elizabeth Barthollet from the Harvard Law School, the Child Advocacy Project, saying we need a presumptive ban on homeschooling. We've got the National Education Association voting regularly that homeschooling cannot provide what children really need. So you've got these forces that are now coming out. In Europe, we're seeing more and more governments actually ban homeschooling, or at least put it under really serious restriction. Why do you think homeschooling is, why do homeschoolers do better? And in light of all that, why in the world would all these different forces want to ban or undermine homeschooling?
Those are great. Yeah. So I think, look at it this way. I try to throw out the H word. Let's not even use the word homeschooling. But I can ask professional educators, government certified teachers, professors of education. I hang out with those people. Ask any parent, ask any young person a series of questions. When do children usually learn more and do better academically? When they're being taught in a group of 28 peers or with two or three or four kids? We all know the answer. When do they do better? When they're being bullied or not bullied? We all know the answer. When do they do better? When they can spend more academic engaged time or less? We all know the answer. When do they do better? If the curriculum and the pedagogical approach are customized to their particular strengths and weaknesses and needs and desires and dreams, or when it's just a one shot fits all for everybody in a group? We all know the answer. So why would the home educated not do better, Alex? That's the real question. Why would they not do better? And I think everybody knows that, but somehow it bothers the sensibility or the pride or the ego of the professionally trained teacher. And somehow it bothers culture, because now for 120 years, the majority of people have been in institutional schools. And so they feel a little bit nervous that somebody could do better than they did. But when they think about it, I get, oh, we could do better. I think another thing is people love control. The home educated are outside of the control of status and power mongers and people who love control. They just need to be able to trust parents, generally speaking. Are there people who do a bad job once in a while? Yes. But look at the public schools. How many kids there are failing, or even by their own standards, not proficient? People should not be worried about homeschoolers as a group at all. They should be encouraging it because they're doing so well.
Yeah. And I've looked at the government's data on the children in public schools, and the 2019 National Assessment of Educational Progress, the NAEP, the nation's report card, showed that less than one third of eighth graders were proficient in any core subject. So, when they fix the government schools, maybe they can come talk to homeschoolers. Until then, I think the difference is very clear. Brian, before we go to break, just a real quick question. You've been following this for decades. Just over the last few years, we've seen a huge influx into homeschooling during COVID. The U.S. Census Bureau, and you probably have better data than they do, but they found that there was almost a doubling of the homeschooling population. And they said that's legitimate homeschoolers, not people doing government school at home. I would guess that some of those have probably gone back into the system. But what are some of the trends, the direction this is going? What are some of the changes you've seen just in recent years and recent decades?
Well, the main trends are this. One, ever since the late 1970s, homeschooling numbers have grown in terms of absolute numbers and in percent of the school age population. Two school years ago, it jumped way up, right? Okay. And then one school year ago, before this one, it dropped back down. However, think of the graph. They can go to my website. It's still going up. So even though it bumped way up and came back down, when it came back down, it was still higher than 2 years before that. So the numbers are increasing. I think the trends are that, we know from research, and I know from experience, that when people are homeschooled, they're more likely to homeschool their children. So in other words, we have more and more graduates who now become parents who will homeschool their children. We also have that the fundamental reasons for homeschooling haven't changed much, Alex, over the last 35 years. People want strong family relationships. They want strong academic education. They want the parents to be able to teach the values instead of the government teach the values and indoctrinate the kids. We see also more in terms of a wider variety. There's always been a variety in homeschooling. People got to get this. There's always been a big variety in homeschooling, all the way from how, whatever stereotypes you want. Right wing Bible thumpers, left wing, you know, grow up, you know, blow up your TV, move to the country, non-Christians. There's always been the variety, but the variety is more obvious now in terms of especially ethnic background and those kinds of things. So we're seeing a huge diversity in homeschooling, and I think that's good for the growth. I think that what we see in research and my personal philosophy, parent-directed, home-based education is good for children. So we're seeing more and more of it. I think it's going to continue growing. However, there are some factors that stop the growth or slow the growth. And I think one of those could be handing tax dollars to the private homeschool movement, which we might talk about later. But, you know, only so many people want to spend that much time with their children. It's a lot of work. It's well worth it. But I think as it grows, people are going to see more and more the advantages of parent-directed home-based education.
There's more to the interview where Dr. Brian Ray gives his thoughts on the danger of government money flowing to homeschoolers, a scheme often referred to as school choice. To see the full interview, go to thenewamerican.com. And we'll be back for our final segment at the other side of this break.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The Declaration of Independence proclaims God-given rights, and we intend to protect them. Working with people like you for over 50 years, preserving freedom and building a better tomorrow. Safeguarding the Constitution by limiting government power. We are restoring liberties, educating voters, and leading the freedom movement. Join with us. United, we will defend our rights. We are all Americans. We are the John Birch Society.
Next up, two members of the John Birch Society's legislative and research team will discuss the latest on the legislative front.
This is Christian Gomez for the New American Magazine, and I'm joined today with our research associate here, Peter Rakowski. Peter, thank you so much for joining us today here at the New American.
It's great to be on, Christian.
So today in the legislative segment, what are we discussing?
Yeah, so today we'll be talking about a bill that was recently introduced in Congress. It's called the Restrict Act. It's numbered Senate Bill 686, and it's sponsored by Senators Mark Werner of Virginia and John Thune of South Dakota, Democrat, Republican, and there are 24 other co-sponsors, Democrats and Republicans, so a bipartisan bill.
So it's bipartisan, so what can go wrong? Because the media on the left, they love when things are bipartisan. But isn't this the bill, though, that is being sold as a bill to ban TikTok? And are we for this bill or are we against it? After all, TikTok is a communist Chinese-owned platform that is taking people's private information. So what is our position on this bill?
Well, the Uniparty is portraying this bill as a bill that would ban TikTok, as you mentioned. But really, it does a lot more than that.
Such as?
So this bill, in summary, would be the biggest expansion of the security state, the police state, since the Patriot Act. So it would be a huge expansion of government surveillance and government control over what we can view and access online. So what the bill does is it allows the federal government, specifically the executive branch, to unilaterally designate any country as a foreign adversary. So Congress's consent is not required. The Secretary of Commerce can do this unilaterally, in any country in the world whatsoever.
So what does that mean in terms of one's ability to go on or not use TikTok or social media in general? How does that affect everyday Americans? What's the implication of that?
Well, when the country is designated a foreign adversary, then it gives the executive branch the authority to block any online service or any online platform that is any way associated with that country. So it could be owned by the government, it could be owned by a private company in that country, But one way or another, the executive branch, once again, without Congress's consent, can ban that. So any American would be banned from viewing or accessing that online.
It's pretty much what other countries do with the U.S. So at least with consent from the U.S., especially like in third world dictatorships, Islamic dictatorships, we see things like Twitter and Facebook that are banned over there because they don't want the individuals of their country, their citizens, talking with each other, potentially participating in any kind of demonstrations. So it sounds like, at least in that regard, that we would be adopting the tactic of an authoritarian regime in trying to restrict people's ability to access certain content, right?
Yeah, exactly. In essence, we would be becoming like China, because that's what the Chinese Communist Party does, in order to supposedly take a stand against China, which obviously makes no sense.
No, that's pretty bad, but there's more to this bill, I take it, from the look of your face, Peter.
Yeah.
So what else is in this bill that makes it a really bad bill?
So any American who still tries to access or view either the service or the provider online, whether they've already done it in the past or whether they're doing it, or even if they're planning on doing it at some future date, even if they haven't done it yet, that's a very, very severe criminal penalty to that. So either, so the minimum is a $250,000 civil fine. So $250,000. Otherwise, it's up to $1 million as a criminal fine, or up to 20 years in jail. So if you want to go on some website that the federal government doesn't want you to look at, you could face up to 20 years in jail and pay $1 million.
So, of course, I imagine this would be after the bill passes in terms of, for example, TikTok. Almost probably every young person under the age of 25 probably has a TikTok account, more than likely. So right now, it's not illegal to access or view that, or any, you know, most other websites, as far as I know, you're free to access whether you should be on them or not. But if this bill becomes law and they start to say this content is banned in the United States, you can no longer access it, I'm assuming they wouldn't go after kids who viewed it before it was illegal. But once it does become illegal, if you viewed it and then they found out later that you viewed it after it became illegal, but you don't view it anymore, but you did at some point when it was illegal, then they can get you on the fines, more than likely.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it won't apply to when you go on before the bill's passed, but after it's passed, any attempts, it'll be a very severe crime under the law.
And, you know, like you said, this is more than just TikTok, because unilaterally they can declare any website or any kind of social media platform or other means of electronic communication as banned with whatever excuse that they want to come up with.
Yes,
right?
And not just China. It could be any country. So if President Biden doesn't like some particular country, let's say Hungary under Viktor Orban, or any other country, he could just designate it as a foreign adversary and then ban any website or platform or app or anything connected to that country.
Okay, we're really running out of time. Just tell us one more really bad aspect about the bill, and then how people can what can they do to stop it?
Yeah, so the federal government could seize and access any type of information related to whatever company they ban. So let's say someone downloads TikTok on their phone, or let's say someone downloads any type of app for any type of website on their phone, or tries to access any type of website on their computer browser.
Like using a VPN, for example, because that's how you could bypass any kind of government blocking.
Yeah. The government could access that, and they wouldn't need a warrant, which is a direct violation of the Fourth Amendment. The government needs a warrant, but under this bill, it says the government can view all this information and not have to obtain a warrant.
So they could, and they could also seize like someone's devices. So they could seize your tablet, your cell phone, your computer, if they suspect or believe or know somehow that you viewed this content, right?
Yeah, that is completely right.
So this is a huge invasion of privacy, a huge expansion of government power. What can people do to stop it? What has JBS produced, I guess, to help combat the passage of this terrible bill?
Yeah, so we have a legislative alert. If anyone goes to jbs.org/alerts, they can view that alert opposing the Restrict Act, Senate Bill 686. It's a very easy way to contact the U.S. representatives, the U.S. senators, and that's what everyone in this country should be doing because, it's ridiculous that this bill has even been introduced, and we can't let it pass, and it's even worse that it's being supported by people of both parties, which shows that, you know, unconstitutional policies are being pushed by both parties, which is, very sad to see, but it's very important that we take a stand and contact Congress and tell them to oppose this bill.
Okay, well, you've heard it from Peter Rakowski. In the name of stopping China, we'll be acting more like communist China unless this bill is stopped. So go to jbs.org/alerts and find this alert under the federal alerts. Thank you so much for your time. Take care and God bless.
Thank you for joining us today. And remember to visit thenewamerican.com for more truth behind the news. We will see you tomorrow.